Hello, and welcome to Offensive Shadows.
Your weekly visit with Abroad, Her Bud, and the Bard.
I'm Mike.
I'm Danny.
And today we're back with The Comedy of Errors, Part 2. And we're going to pick up where we left off last week with Adriana and Luciana.
Or Luciana, depending on how Italian you're feeling on any given day.
I like Luciana, personally.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I was told once by the late, great John Basil, who's not actually late, still alive.
I'm sure he's glad you pointed that out.
Well, I mean, if he's listening, I don't want him to think that, like, he can, you know, like, Hamlet ghost me or anything. That would be really weird. Wake up in the middle of the night and have John Basil at the foot of your bed. Much weirder if you've ever met the man, by the way. Go Google a picture. You'll sort of get an idea. Anyway, he used to say that Luciana was what he called a Lucy-Oosy character, who was kind of, like, not all there, a little bit silly, maybe a little slow, not quite that bright.
I'm not sure that's necessarily a fair appraisal of the character, but I think Luciana could be played as an intelligent character. Actually, in the awful BBC production we saw, I think she was played as a relatively intelligent character.
She was played as a boring character.
She was just a boring character, but then again, most of the characters were boring characters.
I think the key to playing Luciana, or really any of the characters in this play, is you just need to do it bright, brilliant, and bold. But we'll get into that more in the next episode.
I certainly think Adriana, as opposed to Luciana, was written to be more bold, more bright. Luciana is a little bit more laid back, a little bit more traditional. Whereas Adriana is an excellent example of Shakespeare writing a strong woman.
Yeah, she's kind of a spitfire. It's always been interesting to me that between the two women, especially in the scene you just heard in the end of the last episode, and if you didn't hear it, you should go back and listen. The married woman phrases the more feminist sentiments, and I use air quotes around feminism. Check my note on feminism and Taming of the Shrew to see why. And the unmarried woman phrases the more traditional sentiments. So I've always wondered, is Luciana trying to model herself into the perfect woman in hopes of landing a husband? Does she think that saying these things will make her unwed? Will make her wed, rather? She's already unwed.
We almost have an exact opposite relationship here than what we had in Taming of the Shrew. We have the married woman who is probably a model for her younger sister. In fact, we see Luciana at one point playing what she thinks is mediator with Antipholus, trying to preserve the marriage of her sister.
Yeah, but there's no doubt that Adriana and Luciana are close as sisters. And they talk a lot about when they're just alone. They talk a lot about the problems that are on their mind. And for Adriana, that's, oh, my husband, my marriage. And for Luciana, it's like, well, come on, like, be happy with what you have. You have this, like, you know, with the unspoken sort of, and I don't.
Yeah. With the scene that we had at the end of the last episode, we have Adriana being very perceptive, knowing that something's not right when Dromio comes back and says that Antipholus, or specifically what they think is local Antipholus, or Antipholus of Ephesus, is acting weird. Adriana's first thought was, I think he's cheating on me.
Yeah, this play is funny because the characters all draw logical conclusions given the givens of their universe, right? So, like, the humor comes from the fact that there are these two identical twins. Like, who expected that, you know? So everybody who is within the play universe draws a conclusion about the situation that would be completely rational under normal circumstances.
Yeah, I really like that about this play. There is not a single leap that any of the characters make that the audience will question. It is perfectly logical, perfectly reasonable. The only suspension of disbelief the audience has to make is the fact that you have two sets of twins in the same city, probably dressed in the same fashion, in identical clothing.
On the same day. And I think that's what's so brilliant about this show, right? Like, it's completely normal, and it makes it even funnier. There's an old theater axiom: comedy is surprise and recognition. And we have both wrapped in this conceit. The issue of the twins articulates another big point of the play, which is social inequality. I mean, we see it between men and women because Adriana is always talking about marriage and why should he be able to do this and I can't. But
we also have the poor Dromios who got raised in separate circumstances, separate cities, and yet end up in the exact same position.
Yeah, it's kind of sad. Although it's very Elizabethan. The sort of great chain of being is strong within this play.
Although one is married and one is not. Although you have to look and see that among the masters, one is married and one is not also.
Well, Dromio, I'm not sure if Dromio is actually married to Nell so much as Nell is claiming Dromio.
That's true. That's true. I suppose you could play it either way. For Dromio from Syracuse, while Antipholus from Syracuse is having his odd dinner with the woman who claims he is married to, poor Dromio from Syracuse gets stuck with the woman who is claimed Dromio of Ephesus.
And the funny part about this is you don't actually need to put Nell on stage. It's not called for in the script, but usually Dromio is going to be like this little wiry guy who runs around, right? So the thing that a lot of theater companies will do is they'll take their biggest, burliest dude and pad him out to make him look like a really hideous woman and put like an ugly wig on him and make him chase Dromio across the stage a couple times. Because, well, it's pretty funny.
Yes, that would be hysterical. So on the great chain of being, where does Dromio sit and where does Antipholus sit?
Well, it's pretty clear that the Dromios are born servants, they're always going to be servants. Let me sort of backtrack a little. The Great Chain of Being is an Elizabethan concept, or at least a modern projection of an Elizabethan concept, wherein every living thing exists on this great hypothetical chain with, you know, like king and god at the top and like the little ants and things at the bottom. And you're stuck in your link on the chain. And every link links to the link above it and below it, and there is no social mobility. So this play really reinforces that idea because of, as we said, the Dromios being stuck in their caste or their link, I guess, despite the fact that they were raised in two very separate situations.
So most of Act 2 in Act 3 is comprised of this kind of back and forth, this hilarity and mistaken identity, where the Dromios and the Antipholi get stuck in different positions, while the Antipholus from Syracuse is at dinner with a woman he doesn't know. At the same time, that woman's husband is locked out of his own house because, but of course, the master and servant of the house are already in there.
As sort of a sidebar, the fact that they're called the Antipholi always amuses me. In my head, that should be the name of somebody's imaginary pet elephant.
And so while the pet elephants are locked out of the house.
Only one of them, only half the pet elephant.
At the same time, the Antipholus mistaken identity is going on as Dromio is getting abused by Nell, who's throwing herself at him. The two gentlemen from Syracuse, Dromio and Antipholus, manage to extricate themselves from these circumstances and are quite confused as to what's going on. And there's a great scene that's called the country scene.
Or I call it the country scene.
Whereas Dromio is lamenting to Antipholus what exactly was going on while he was stuck at dinner with Adriana. We actually have for you that scene. It's hysterical if it's done well. It does have a lot of physical comedy in it, but I think we have a decent production here just for audio.
Why, how now, Dromio? Where runnest thou so fast?
Do you know me, sir? Am I Dromio? Am I your man? Am I myself?
Thou art Dromio. Thou art thy man. Thou art thyself.
I am an ass. I am a woman's man, and besides myself.
What, woman's man? And how besides thyself?
Marry, sir, besides myself, I am due to a woman. One that claims me. One that haunts me. One that will have me.
What claim lays she to thee?
Marry, sir, such a claim as you would lay to your horse.
What is she?
A very reverent body. Aye, such a one as a man may not speak of without he say, Sir Reverence, I have been but lean luck in the match, and yet is she a wondrous fat marriage.
How dost thou mean a that marriage.
Marry, sir, she's the kitchen wench in all Greece, and I know not what use to put her to, but to make a lamp of her and run from her by her own light. I warrant her rags and the tallow in them would burn a Poland winter. If she lives till doomsday, she'll burn a week longer than the whole world.
What complexion is she of?
Swart, like my shoe, but her face nothing half so clean kept, for why she sweats, a man may go over shoes in the grime of it.
Ah, that's a fault that water will mend.
No, sir, 'tis ingrain. Noah's flood could not do it.
What's her name?
Nell, sir. But her name in three quarters, that's an L, and three quarters would not measure her from hip to hip.
Ooh. Then she, bears some breadth.
No longer from head to foot than from hip to hip. She is spherical, like a globe. I could find out countries in her.
In what part of her body lies Ireland?
Mary, in her buttocks. I found it out by the bogs.
Where's Scotland?
I found it by the barrenness, hard in the palm of her hand.
Where France?
In her forehead, armed and reverted, making war against her hair.
Where England?
I looked for the chalky cliffs, but I could find no whiteness in them. But I guess it stood in her chin by the salt room that ran between France and it.
Where's Spain?
Faith, I saw it not, but felt it hot in her breath.
Ooh, where America? The Indies?
Oh, sir, upon her nose, all o'er embellished with rubies, carbuncles, sapphires, declining their rich aspect to the hot breath of Spain.
Where stood Belgia? The Netherlands?
Oh, sir, I did not look so low. To conclude, this drudge or diviner laid claim to me, called me Dromio, swore I was assured to her, told me what privy marks I had about me, as the mark on my shoulder, the mole in my neck, the great wart on my left arm, that I, amazed, ran from her as a witch.
Go hide thee presently, post to the road, and if the wind blow any way from shore, I will not harbor in this town tonight. If everyone knows us, and we know none, 'tis time, I think, to trudge, pack, and be gone.
As from a bear a man would run for life, so fly I from her that would be my wife.
And that's it for this week. Next week we'll have the wrap-up, Acts 4 and 5, and a little bit about the setting of the play and the city itself.
Thanks for listening. Offensive Shadows would like to thank Mr. Christopher Knowles for the beautiful logo art, Mr. Matthew Rosevalley for the lovely music, and the vocal stylings of Mr. Angelo Calderon and Gavin Fishman.
We have our typical Mike Flubs the Open.